Some of this work is work that I've done and it's been published, and then some of the work towards the end, which is more of the sociocultural context work, is actually really data that we collected in this project, but that it's ongoing. So it'd be great to hear your thoughts on what we're doing, and so we have some interesting findings, and so I'm happy to share
Okay,
this.
very happy with that. So, I mean, I'm sure there's not really a need for a formal introduction other than saying that you were the Faculty of Epidemiology in the Rowland School of Public Health at Emory University, and that the work that you do examines impacts of social determinants, focusing on violence, housing, neighborhood factors on health across the life course. So my interest in this is in relation to neighborhood effects with respect to food, physical activity, obesity, and chronic disease. And you're interested in learning how these social factors operate, affect health through a stress pathway. And again, we've just published work with Danish and Swedish colleagues on stress pathways to childhood obesity. So, I think there's some synergy there. So I'd be very happy to, if we can, have the talk and also start a conversation. That would be so nice.
That sounds great. So let me get started, and I might skip over some things or just go maybe a little bit briefly over some stuff. So I work on early life adversity and cardiometabolic health, and I kind of like to talk about how I think and define child adversity, because I know people, there's sort of various definitions of how people put together this construct of early childhood adversity. So I think of it as these external events or conditions, really not just events, that may threaten the child's body, the familial, their social safety or security of the child. And then there's a host of different things that we can characterize a child adversity, but they're mainly fall into these buckets of household dysfunction, child maltreatment, violence that's not maltreatment or domestic violence, so violence that a child may encounter at home, I mean, in the neighborhood or dating or at school. And then there are other adverse experiences that, depending on the population that we're focusing on, may experience more often, really based on sort of neighborhood environments and sociodemographics to a certain extent. And so in the US, the Center for Disease Control has sort of depicted this ACEs pyramid of how like these adverse experiences impact health across the lifespan, sort of noting that they have these impact on neurodevelopment, on social emotional cognitive impairment, and risky behaviors and disease, disability, and then early death. And I'm interested in how these processes, basically mostly for through the behavioral pathway, are impacting cardiometabolic health. But I'm really interested in sort of like the whole lifespan and the impact of it, all the way from conception to early death. And so if we think of it as a within like the sociocological model, really thinking about like these factors mostly that I focus in are in the family, sort of individual level family, the family environment. And so in the US, the ACEs are highly prevalent, or experiencing at least one of this is highly prevalent. This is data from the what we call the BRFSS survey, which is this nationally representative phone survey of adults who are, and then one of the modules that was included in 23 states was this ACE module, and adults were asked to retrospectively report about their experiences with these ACEs. And the prevalence of experience at least one ACE in the US is 59%, which is really high. And then there's this gradient, the socioeconomic gradient, where adults who report having less than a high school education as their highest educational attainment have a higher prevalence of a number of these ACEs. So if you look at, for example, experience in physical abuse, you're looking at 26% compared to 13% at the highest education level.
Can I just ask you whether this is I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, it's fine.
Is this a nationally representative survey?
So it's supposed to be nationally representative. However, the way the BRFSS works is that there's a standard survey that all 50 states have to administer every year. So it's kind of like a panel, right? You get it's a cross-sectional panel, it's a phone survey. And then states can opt what modules are going to include, what additional questionnaires are going to include. And the ACEs is in one of those additional modules, and not every state has assessed it. So there's 23 states that included it, but not every. So it's representative to a certain extent, but it's not capturing the entire US. We're not representative of every state in the US.
But in terms of socio-demographics, is it pretty
Yeah.
representative?
Yes, it is diverse in terms of sociodemographics. Yes, race, ethnicity, and education level, with the caveat that you need to have a phone and people need to find you, right? You need to pick up the phone. That's sort of the catchment of it. But yes, it's representative.
Super. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so with a number of these ACEs, there's this gradient where if you have a high, call it, or the highest level of education, your prevalence of the ACEs, it's lower. And then something similar has been done, but then not asking adults about retrospective experiences, but then this is asking parents about their kids' current experiences. So this is the National Survey of Children's Health, which is also supposed to be representative of children in the United States, and they ask the parents to report on their kids' experiences. And there is this disparity or this difference by race, ethnicity, when we look at kids who experience no ACEs, one or two or more. So kids who identify as Black or African American, or kids who identify as Hispanic or Latino, are more likely to have one, at least one ACE. And then Black children are more likely to have two or more of these ACEs, and as well as children who belong to other race, ethnicity, not captured within these four groups. And so part of the rationale for this is, so I talked about, these ACEs are at the individual family level, but the root causes of it are really at, deeper levels than just this individual family level. So there's all these, neighborhood level, sociopolitical factors, social factors that are influencing the likelihood of a child experience any one of these ACEs. So that, this is sort of like the reason why we're seeing these disparities across SES and across race and ethnicity. And so it's true that the factors that we're focusing on, the ACEs, are at the family individual level, but then there's these, neighborhood and sociopolitical factors that are also influencing these individual and family level factors. And so then, with that background, jumping onto the work on cardiometabolic health. So one of the earliest, studies to look at this with to look at this is the Vincent Fellini and Robert Anda study on ACEs in the US, using the Kaiser Permanente health insurance data, where they retrospectively asked adults to report on whether they had experienced any of these experiences prior to age 18. And they then looked at, sort of just summed over and very crudely, just, yes or no, did you experience these things, and just sum over. And they found these, dose response gradient with these ACEs and a number of chronic health conditions in adulthood, one of those being heart disease, which is the focus of my work. And so this is one of the papers they published on heart disease, where they looked at, as the number of these ACEs increases, the odds of heart disease increases. So you have this dose response. And despite, adjustment for a number of what they call the traditional risk factors of cardiovascular disease and, other psychological risk factors, the association is persistent, particularly when you're looking at, experiencing, more than, three or more of these ACEs. And so this has been replicated in a number of different studies. This is a systematic review looking at the accumulation of adversity in cardiometabolic disease, where they note this, higher, depending on whether studies looked at hazards ratio or they looked at odds ratio, they still find this consistent association across a number of studies. There's this, another systematic review that specifically looked at childhood maltreatment, not all the ACEs, but maltreatment. And they also note that there was this consistent association, 22 of the 24 studies reviewed, find this association with cardiovascular disease. And then this is one specifically with obesity, which is what I'm going to focus on moving forward. Really looking at child maltreatment and obesity. And again, you have this consistent association with maltreatment and obesity in adulthood.
Can I just ask you, sorry again,
Yes.
the early studies there seem to show a much bigger effect than later studies. Do you think there's been a change in methodology or definition that might have contributed to that, or?
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. I need to go back and see like the if there is some sort of commonality with it. I think just from working in the field, I do think we've gotten a little bit better about characterizing child maltreatment. And maybe like with more refined scales and measures, so that might be what we're getting maybe more precise estimates. So they're bigger estimates, but you have these wider confidence intervals too. Oops. So it's possible that's one of the reasons why. But I'm gonna go back and actually check and see like what if there's some commonality across these studies or whether it's the sample size. More I think. More quote unquote recently since the this is a still a paper from 2014, but that these maltreatment questions are now included in larger surveys, which I think in the potentially in the 90s, like we wouldn't have these maltreatment measures included in very large surveys. So maybe this is also a possibility these are smaller studies. Like I know some of these studies, sort of the more recent studies that are been done in larger cohorts. So that might be the sort of the precision issue too.
Super. And it's a dumb question. Do you think the definition of childhood maltreatment is reasonably uniform across countries? Because looking at the authorship, I mean, of course,
Yeah.
the US, but also a lot of European studies in there, as far as I can see.
I wouldn't assume that it is uniform. Yeah. I mean, I think now if studies are using like, childhood trauma questionnaire or some validated scale, then yeah. Well, I should say validated, but some, more widely used scales. But I wouldn't assume that it's uniform because I've seen sort of how, some studies may ask certain questions so that there may be some difference in how it's being defined. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. No, those are really good points. I hadn't thought about this. So in regards to cardiometabolic health, I work with the American Heart Association and a number of colleagues in trying to sort of come to a well, maybe it really was a statement, but trying to come to a conceptual framework of how do we think that these adverse experiences, either individually or cumulatively, may be impacting cardiovascular disease? And so, this is a diagram depiction of sort of what we were thinking of are the potential pathways, and it's complex because I think the relationships are complex. So the idea here that these adversities are impacting health behaviors is one of the pathways. That they're impacting physiological mechanisms, which is, another pathway, and then impacting as a third pathway, substance use and mental health. And there's sort of varying degrees of evidence for each one of these potential mechanisms where, maybe we have like a lot of data, for example, on the impact of adversity and substance use and mental health, and maybe, now more emerging data on like physiological mechanisms. The bidirectional arrows between the pathways sort of represent the fact that, each one of these pathways is also able to impact another pathway. So we know that mental health is going to impact your health behaviors, that is going to impact your physiological mechanisms, and vice versa. And these behaviors are going to impact physiological mechanisms. So it does really become rather complex and, how these relationships are operating. And so it's not that it's just, adversity impacts this and this impacts cardiovascular disease. There's sort of this interplay between all these different pathways. And then those pathways together or, individually are impacting these cardiovascular risk factors. So development of obesity, hypertension, and diabetes. And that's largely the work that I do. So I focus more on the younger populations and the impact on these cardiovascular risk factors. Personally, I'm just more interested in how these processes happening to increase the risk prior to the development of cardiovascular disease. It's sort of my particular interest. But then we also have these other physiological mechanisms, and then ultimately cardiovascular morbidity and mortality. And then in this box over here, which I'll talk about, is the fact that there are a number of factors that may moderate or change how a particular population may be impacted by adversity in relation to cardiometabolic health. So, based on your race or ethnicity, you just may be more likely to experience some of these adversities or experience some types of adversities that other people are not experiencing, as well as maybe have a differential, excuse me, response to those adversities. We've seen a lot of actually differences across sex at birth, so which I'll show in a minute. And then there's other potential factors of how like individual and neighborhood environment may just modify, how the adversities are impacting some of these processes. So one of the first analysis that I worked on, really interested in the cumulative nature of these factors, was with the Fragile Families and Child Wellbeing Study, which is not called Fragile anymore. They finally changed the name, and I can't remember what the name is, but it's now a much more positive term. The study, I don't know if you're familiar with the study, but the study is called or was called Fragile Families because it was designed to look at the majority of the population was focusing on single female-headed households, so unwed mothers who were raising their children, and then there, I guess that's where the fragile term came, and how their children, to understand, child development. And so this was a birth cohort in the U.S. Representative of that population of single female-headed households. They followed the kids longitudinally. They did assessments at birth at age 1, 3, 5, 9, 15, and now there's an adolescent assessment. And so this work that I first did was really to look at how try to understand how early in the life course we could see this impact of these social factors on childhood obesity. And so we looked at the mother's reporting of these different factors and obesity in the kids at age 5. So moms were reporting of these things at age 1 and 3, and then obesity at age 5. And then these are not your traditional ACEs, right? There's like, we have a measure here of housing insecurity and food insecurity. That was really prevalent in this cohort. So it just made sense to include it because that was part of the cumulative social risk. Because this is not, what we'd be defined as adversity per se, but what are the social risk factors that cumulatively that these kids are experiencing? And so what we saw is that the odds of obesity are much higher for children who have experienced one or, two to three or four more as we categorize it, but that the association was really with the girls, and we were just not seeing, excuse me, an association with the boys. And so We dug a little deeper on this to try to understand whether this association was explained by some of these behaviors or some of the behavioral problems that had been assessed in the cohort. And so we looked at externalizing behaviors and internalizing behaviors. We looked at sleep duration. This is kind of crude. It's just less than 9 hours of sleep duration. Whether the kids were watching more than 2 hours of TV, which is sort of like the recommended pediatric, American Academy of Pediatrics, use of TV, and then more than three drinks of soda and juice. There's no good measure in fragile families of like physical activity or like diet in early childhood. And so these are sort of markers to try to get at, is there something that's getting us this, these behavioral measures. And so we included this in the model, and this doesn't it didn't affect the estimates. We still see this persistent association among girls that we just don't see among boys, although we do see, as expected, that externalizing problems are still associated with obesity, as well as short sleep duration, increased TV and increased TV watching, but only among the boys. So I have hypothesis, but not a clear explanation of why we would see this just in the girls and not in the boys at this very early age. So there are sex differences that we've seen, in adolescence or in adulthood. And so there's, pubertal developmental, differences or hormonal differences that may account for the impact of stress on some cardiometabolic outcomes. There may be differential coping mechanisms that sometimes we see. And so there's this hypothesis that women are more likely to cope with stress with like a sedentary lifestyle and, different eating behaviors. And, younger boys may cope with more physical activity. But that's not the case here. These are 5-year-olds, right? This is potentially maybe what we've hypothesized is that within this context of single female-headed households, girls may be more internalizing more of the adversity or, whatever trauma or stress that the moms are experiencing. And that may be why we're seeing this association here. Or that the way that moms were experiencing, right? Because it's the kids' experiences, but really it's like the mom's experiences of mental health, housing insecurity, food insecurity, that the moms are just differentially have differential parent behaviors depending on the kid's gender. And so one of the studies that fragile families did later on with the age 9 group is that they noted that if there was a violent neighborhood, the girls' physical activity decreased because moms wouldn't let girls play outside if they lived in a violent neighborhood, but they would let the boys, play outside. So, in parallel, their potential, parenting practices different, sexual norm, different sex norm differences in parenting behavior that may be playing a role here, in addition to potentially like this internalizing of experiences that maybe the girls are having and not the boys. Again, this is sort of like my own kind of hypothesis of why we see these differences. We have no kind of way of actually, testing that. But then later on, and with the, so this is work with the adolescent National Longitudinal Adolescent to Adult Health, which is a cohort in the United States that has followed adolescents into adulthood. Kari Clark's a colleague who's now also here at Emory did this work, and I collaborated with her looking at the impact of both child maltreatment and experiences of dating violence and domestic violence in adolescence and young adulthood, and how BMI was changing from adolescence to young adulthood. And we do see this increase in BMI change from adolescence to adulthood among women who experience domestic violence. It's not there among men. And then we see it again among women who experience abuse. And we just don't see it among men. And with the maltreatment, I don't think I have the slide here. Actually, I don't. But with the maltreatment, what we later saw is that there's an interaction between sexual abuse and domestic violence, and the impact is much higher among women who experience both sexual abuse and domestic violence. And we don't see it, and don't see it among men. It is true that within ad health, the prevalence of experience of sexual abuse is much higher among women compared to men. So part of this is just differential exposure in terms of the impact, but we also see this sex difference even among the men who experience maltreatment. We just don't see an association. And ad health doesn't have great diet measure to try to understand some of the behavioral factors that we did, we looked at in the fragile families, but they do have some health behavior measures that can be examined. So Allison Kamek worked with me. She was a postdoctoral fellow. She's now at the CDC, and so she looked at child maltreatment and characterized these eating behaviors in terms of or not just eating, but eating and potential sedentary behaviors in a way to look at them as potentially excessive or like addictive behaviors. So characterizing not just in terms of do you have a healthy diet, do you have an unhealthy diet, but like are you consuming really large amounts of certain foods or really watching a lot of TV and computer use. And so there's no kind of real clinical way to characterize this. So we did sort of this data-driven approach where we looked at just the top 10 percentile, the 90th percentile cutoff of consuming, a lot of sugar and sweetened beverages, sort of like using maybe the sugar as a marker for, coping with sugar or fast food consumption, or just using a lot of computer and TV use. And then the advantage with ad health is that it actually has a really nice detailed measure of child maltreatment. And this kind of gets, Stanley, at your earlier question of like, are we measuring maltreatment the same way? And I would say no. Ad health, for example, is one that, and I don't see this in a lot of large surveys that characterize maltreatment also based on the perpetrator. So they included questions on who was a perpetrator of the abuse, a parent, a caregiver, or a non-parent caregiver when it was related to sexual abuse, and even went as far as looking at, physical force or non-physical threat on sexual abuse. These are sort of characterizations that we often don't really see in large surveys. So ad health is somewhat unique on that. And so we did some kind of detailed analysis on type of or on perpetrator, but then also sort of like more detail on the sexual abuse. But what I'll show you is in the cumulative maltreatment measure. So when we looked at cumulative maltreatment, this is among men. We do see that men who experience two or more of different types of child maltreatment exhibited more or engage in more of these excessive behaviors of consuming a lot of sugar sweetened beverages and fast foods and using a lot of TV and video excessively. And then we look at women, the association is even higher. And then we also see it with just one experience of child maltreatment or one cumulative maltreatment experience, not just with the two that we had seen with men. So there's a suggestion that potentially women are engaging more in these addictive or if we can classify them as addictive excessive behaviors and that men, which may explain some of the differences that we've seen with BMI changes and other cardiometabolic health associations with maltreatment and sex differences across men and women. And so I mentioned that, I see. So I mentioned these moderators and this conceptual framework. And so the work on this is a little bit more of the ongoing work that I'm it's not completely some of it is published, but the work on adiposity and early adversity in this cohort is not published. So this is a project that I've been working on within a cohort. Let me see if I have I'll explain. Looking at the time, but okay. This is a project that I've been working on with a Puerto Rican population that's living in two different social contexts. So one is Puerto Ricans in the South Bronx, New York, and one is and the other side is in the island in San Juan, Puerto Rico. And I'll talk a little bit about the study design of what we're doing in that way. So I mentioned that there's the potential moderators by which that could impact how adversity is having an impact on cardiovascular risk factors. And this is one study that directly addresses that. And the rationale is that potentially the context is going to influence the timing, the duration, or the type of the adversity that children are experiencing, but that also that these factors may be influencing may have, there's maybe positive factors or other resiliency factors that may modify whether these, and how these adversities are impacting health outcomes, and so broadly, biological, psychological, physical health. And so I mentioned this at the beginning. So we have this focus on these individual level markers, but there are these neighborhood and these other sociopolitical factors that are influencing the impact of these adversities and how families may be able to cope if they experience one of these adversities, or the likelihood that they may be experience these adversities. And so within racial and ethnic populations, and particularly Latino populations, they may experience particular types of factors that other groups may not experience. So this is why I do a lot of work that's sort of like within a particular group. So within the Latino population, because they might may just they have just these unique characteristics that other groups may not have. So I'm an advocate for sort of like within group analysis to get at the nitty-gritty of like, what are these distinct sociopolitical, sociocultural factors that may be influencing or changing how these factors are impacting health, and would help us potentially then address how these adverse experiences are impacting health. So just a little bit of background. So there's a huge population of Latinos across the United States, largely immigrants from different Latin American countries. And they're not a human homogeneous groups, even though Latinos in the US are often classified as sort of this one group. They're like Latinos, Hispanics, but the country of origin, obviously there's very different lived experiences because these populations are coming from different cultural backgrounds, different political, sociopolitical backgrounds that they've experienced in their country, different immigration histories in the United States. And Puerto Ricans in particular obviously have their own kind of sociopolitical history, but then compared to other Latino groups in the United States, they unfortunately have experienced more adverse child adversities than other Hispanic groups in the United States. And they also experience more mental and physical health outcomes compared to other Latino groups. And a lot of this data comes from a study that's called the Hispanic Community Health Study, the study of Latinos, which is a study in the United States that recruited a Latino adults at four different states, four different sites, to try to get at this heterogeneity of the Latino population in the United States. And so they're able to compare Latinos in the U.S. of different countries of origin, and how and their protective and risk factors in relation to cardiometabolic health. So this is where the majority of this data is coming from. This is a picture of Puerto Rico that I took when I was there not too long ago. So I was born and raised there, and so this is where I have a kind of personal connection to this study and what I've sort of sought out doing this work. So if you're not familiar, Puerto Rico is this, tiny island in the Caribbean that was under Spanish rule up until 1898, and then it became became a U.S. territory. It's essentially a colony of the United States. Puerto Ricans are have U.S. citizenship. They've been granted U.S. citizenship for many years now. They have their own government, but they're also are subject as a U.S. territory to some federal rules. But then they don't have the advantages of being a state. So economically, it's a more, disadvantage because they do. There's some policies that are impacting the island. It's gone through a big political and economic crisis in recent years, along with natural disasters. So it's been suffered a number of different crises and a different number of levels, if you will. And I should say that in the States, there's a huge population of Puerto Ricans because there was a mutually beneficial migration from Puerto Ricans to come to the US to work and for the US to actually promote and encourage Puerto Ricans to come to the US to work back in the 1950s and 60s. And New York was one of the sites where a lot of Puerto Ricans settled. So there's a big population of Puerto Ricans in in the US and then and particularly in New York. And so this cohort kind of is tapping into that population of Puerto Ricans in New York, particularly in the South Bronx of New York City. This population of Puerto Ricans has been there for many years. So these are not like recent, families who have recently arrived. And the study was designed to look at this population and look at this comparable population or parallel population in the metro area in San Juan, Puerto Rico. The study was designed by Hector Bird back in 2000 to look at how child development differed across these two different social contexts. And they recruited children between 5 and 13 years of age. The only criterion was that the caretaker identified as being of Puerto Rican background. It was a household probability sample. So it's the samples representative of the South Bronx and is representative of the San Juan metro area. They did there. There's been three waves of data collected, and then one wave of data collected in young adulthood. And then I developed a ancillary study, which is this cardiovascular health assessment in a subsample of the participants at about age. Actually, it's really like 23, so young, but young adulthood. And so they've collected a number of measures of adversities prospectively. So they asked the parents, and when developmentally appropriate, they asked the children to also report on a number of these experiences. And they collected them repeatedly. So at every wave, they attempted to collect these measures. And unfortunately, there is a really high prevalence of these adversities in the cohort. There are some differences across the site, across sites, but still, kind of high levels of adversity. So in the Bronx, you have really high prevalence of parental divorce and separation compared to Puerto Rico. And then you have a higher prevalence of maltreatment, particularly physical abuse and emotional abuse. And then in Puerto Rico, you actually have a higher prevalence of mental health problems with the caretakers, substance use problems, and of intimate partner violence than you do in the Bronx. But still, overall, it's an unfortunately population that experiences or experienced a lot of adversity in childhood. And so we looked at these adversities as they relate to a different number of behavioral factors and then physiological factors. So we looked early on at these ACEs and sleep disturbances in the cohort in childhood and see these really high prevalence ratios when we're looking at experiencing two or more of these ACEs and things like trouble falling asleep or daytime sleepiness and bad dreams and nightmares. We don't actually see site differences. So not every analysis that we've done, we've noted that there's site differences. This is one, for example, where we were noting the same association between adversity and sleep problems. And then we've looked at the timing of pubertal development and the tempo of pubertal development, with this thought that adversity may, or that pubertal development may be one of the, or early or late pubertal development may be in the pathway between adversity and cardiometabolic risk. And so, again, this is one of these analysis where site was not a factor. So there were no site differences that we noted, but we do note this site difference, these sex differences, in that girls who experience two or more adversities have earlier pubertal development, so more accelerated pubertal development, no differences with the tempo. So because they collected pubertal development over time, we're able to see how pubertal development, the rate of change of pubertal development over time, but they didn't really see any differences based on tempo. But for the boys, what we do see in terms of the timing is opposite what we had seen for the girls, that boys who experience adversity actually have a later pubertal development than boys who don't experience adversity. So, these sex differences that we've seen prior to, I think what a lot of this work is showing is that there are different potential mechanisms by why we may see them. And they also differ over the time period like that we're looking at. So these are, pubertal at adolescent boys, where we're seeing these differences that may drive what we may be seeing some differences in cardiometabolic health, where our other work, net health, may be pointed towards differential use of behaviors as coping mechanisms, so that there there's this potential multiple factors that may be driving why we see some sex differences over different time periods in the life course. And then in regards to at the adiposity measures, what we're seeing in this cohort is, unfortunately, high levels of adiposity. So there's a high prevalence of obesity in our population in the South Bronx, and even in our population in Puerto Rico. High prevalence of high levels of waist circumference across the cohort in of body fat. And the sort of an analysis that we're sort of grappling with or understanding now is this relationship between adversities. And here I'm showing you the about treatment specific analyses and the adiposity measures by site. So this is in New York, where we're seeing, consistent to what we have seen before in other work in the US, that the relationship between maltreatment or adversity is among women, and that we don't see it among men. And so you have these higher estimates of body fat, waist circumference, and obesity for women who are exposed to emotional abuse, and also women who are exposed to sexual abuse. And we just don't see these associations among men. But when we look at our cohort in Puerto Rico, we just see something completely different. And so here the association is in the opposite direction, where what we're seeing is among men, and to some extent among women, that the association between maltreatment and these adiposity measures is lower. Oh, and this should say beta estimates. I apologize. These are not prevalence ratios. These are beta estimates. So that physical abuse, sexual abuse, is predicting a lower body fat, lower waist circumference, lower obesity, and even among women who experience neglect, we see something similar. So, how is the sociocultural contents changing or sort of modifying these associations is something that we're trying to understand as a next step of what could potentially be driving these factors. And so we're looking at, we have measures of diet, smoking, and substance use in this cohort. So that's one of the things that we're looking at, if the potential coping behaviors are, or not coping behavior, there's potential behavioral factors are different. We do also have coping that we can look at in the cohort, and other potential factors that may explain this difference. There was this cohort actually that compared sort of like similarly kind of two different contexts, looking at ACEs and adiposity and adolescence. And sort of I've gone through this, and I because it sort of resonates with the findings that we're having, where within the ALSPAC cohort they do find this association, and then comparably where would they look at the Pelotas cohort in this very different context, they actually don't see this association at all. There was actually a sort of a suggestion of a decrease in the BMI as we see in our cohort, although that was not statistically significant. So there's some evidence that context may change, but what is it and how is it that context is changing? And it's, I guess, open for discussion. One of the things that we thought about, which is potentially maybe what factor that may be operating here in the Pelotas cohort, is the fact that the maltreatment may be representing a more disadvantaged environment, and more socioeconomically disadvantaged environment that may not lead to this higher adiposity measure as it does in a high income country. And that may be something similar to what we're seeing in Puerto Rico. And I think actually I said maybe some of these things that I was mentioning, that the impact of maltreatment and adiposity just may depend on this moderating factors. What we see is a lot of differences across sex, and now we're seeing these sociocultural contextual differences, and that these there's variation also potentially in the maltreatment experiences across these contexts. So we're capturing one way, there may actually be representing something maybe slightly different, which may result in this differential health effects. And then within the Puerto Rican cohort, we have a number of measures on familialism, cultural identity, social support, things that are very particular to this population that I'm really interested to look, deeper in, to try to understand why we're seeing these potential differences. This is, and I kind of always like to end with this slide because I like to acknowledge the things that I don't talk about. So this is a recommendation from another group that I work with the National Institutes of Health, because I talk a lot about the negative, but there's a lack of studies looking at resilience, which I did not talk about at all, and sort of these positive factors and these buffers of adversity, as well as intervention studies and studies that really are capturing, how may we begin to address these adversities, natural experiments, other type of studies that would inform how we would move forward and actually address these adverse experiences, and potentially prevent more worse health outcomes. Yeah, and that's my info, how people can find me if they have questions or want to reach out.